I want you to try a little thought experiment with me today. Imagine trying to compress an entire decade of political climbing into just 24 months.
That is a, well, it's a massive leap.
Right, because we are talking about the kind of methodical, grueling ascent that usually takes a politician from, say, a local state legislature, maybe to a high-profile cabinet position.
Yeah, or a governor's mansion.
Exactly. And then a stint in the U.S. Senate, and finally culminating in a run for the presidency. So imagine trying to squeeze all of that traditional credential building into just 2 years.
It sounds impossible.
How do you even begin to engineer that kind of quantum leap without the whole thing just falling apart?
Well, it is fundamentally an incredible pacing problem. I mean, you are basically trying to hack the American political machine.
Yeah.
To pull that off, a candidate has to build universal national name recognition, raise genuinely staggering amounts of money, and somehow prove they have the gravitas to manage the nuclear codes.
While currently running a local state-level race.
Exactly.
Which brings us to our mission for today's deep dive. We have our hands on a fascinating, highly detailed independent strategy report.
It's a great read.
It really is. It was jointly produced by the American newspaper and American TV, and it's dated August 15th, 2026.
So very recent.
Right. And this document is essentially a masterclass in modern political architecture. It maps out a hypothetical, step-by-step 2028 presidential run for James Tallarico.
Who, for context, is currently a Democratic state representative in Texas and a former public school teacher.
And just to set the timeline for you, as of this August 2026 report, he is not a declared presidential candidate.
No, not at all. He is deep in the trenches running for the U.S. Senate in Texas.
Right. But the authors of this document are treating him as a real-time test case for where the future of political strategy is heading.
Yeah, they're modeling what a post-2024 campaign apparatus actually looks like.
And just as a quick note for you listening, because we are, diving deep into some highly charged, hyper-specific political strategies today, we aren't here to pick sides.
Definitely not.
Right, whether it's left-wing populism or right-wing strategy,
Right.
our job today is purely to pop the hood on this 2026 report and show you the mechanics of how these modern campaigns are engineered.
Just looking at the data.
Exactly. We are looking at the math, the media, and the tactics, not telling you how to vote.
And the mechanics are exactly what make this document so compelling. But mapping out a theoretical 2028 run is putting the cart miles ahead of the horse.
Because of the Senate race.
Right, because there is a massive, immediate roadblock standing in the way in November 2026.
The 2026 hinge. This report makes it crystal clear that the entire 2028 presidential blueprint hinges entirely on Tallarico's current Senate battle against the Republican incumbent Ken Paxton.
Texas is ground zero.
Ground zero.
And what jumps out immediately from the data in this report is just how agonizingly close this Senate race actually is.
Wait, really? Close in Texas.
Yeah, and what that closeness signals to national operatives is huge. Late July 2026 polls have Tallarico slightly ahead, which in Texas is an anomaly. We are looking at a 45 to 40 margin in a Texas public opinion research poll and a tighter 47 to 43 in a Texas A&M poll.
Okay, but standard polling error could easily erase those leads, right?
Absolutely. But the financial data is the metric that cannot be ignored here.
The money is genuinely staggering. The report notes that for a Senate challenger, Tallarico pulled in $31.6 million in just the last quarter alone.
It's wild.
Cumulatively, since 2025, he has raised $72 million.
Which is just a massive footprint.
To put that in perspective, Paxton has raised $16.8 million. I mean, a state representative is dwarfing a universally known incumbent in fundraising.
And that unprecedented financial footprint is the sole reason this strategy report even exists. It proves he has national scale donor capacity.
Which you need.
Right, it's the baseline requirement for a presidential run. But the report doesn't assume victory. It outlines three very distinct scenarios for what happens when the votes are counted in November 2026.
Okay, let's hear them.
Scenario one is the ideal. He wins. That instantly creates a national myth. He becomes the Democrat who actually flipped Texas.
Which gives him this aura of invincibility.
Exactly.
Scenario two, though, is the cautionary tale. A narrow loss. This is what the report explicitly calls the Beto problem.
Right, and we should unpack that reference for a second. They are talking about Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah, who gained massive national fame and raised mountains of donor money after narrowly losing his Texas Senate race to Ted Cruz in 2018.
But when O'Rourke tried to parlay that momentum into a 2020 presidential run, the campaign fizzled out almost immediately.
Because voters ultimately felt he lacked a track record of actual governing.
Right. You get the fame and the donor list from a narrow loss, but you have no institutional credibility to back it up.
And then scenario three is just a large standard margin loss, which completely collapses the whole electability argument.
The 2028 dream dies right there on election night.
But let me push back on this whole premise for a second, because treating a 2026 Senate race like a pilot episode for a 2028 television series feels recklessly ambitious.
It's a huge gamble.
It's like an indie film director mortgaging their house, their car, and their parents' retirement to fund one single movie.
Yeah, all in on one project.
If it hits the festival circuit, they're suddenly an A-lister. If it flops, they are directing local car dealership commercials for the rest of their life.
That's a great analogy.
But even in the best case scenario, let's say he actually wins this Senate race. How does a guy who was just voting on municipal zoning in the state legislature overcome the inevitable inexperience attack?
That's the million-dollar question.
Like, if I'm a voter, how do I trust this guy with international diplomacy or the military?
Well, that experience gap is the single biggest red flag raised in this document. The authors are brutally honest about his vulnerabilities.
That he has zero federal, military, or executive experience.
Right. If he miraculously wins that Senate seat in November 2026, he only has a tiny, almost impossibly short window to build a national security profile before the 2028 primary machinery effectively turns on.
I mean, he would have to step off the victory stage and immediately start acting like a seasoned statesman.
He'd have to forcefully secure spots on major Senate committees like foreign relations or armed services.
Oh, yeah.
And start speaking fluently about international alliances and trade agreements by January. It is an incredibly steep learning curve.
And any misstep on the international stage during that first year in the Senate would be magnified 1,000 times. By his presidential rivals.
Exactly. So, assuming he navigates that minefield, we have to look at what he is actually selling.
The brand?
Yes. The political brand the report outlines for him is fascinating because it doesn't fit neatly into the boxes we are used to.
It isn't your standard corporate-friendly centrism.
And it isn't traditional coastal progressivism either.
Yeah.
It is a highly specific, very deliberate hybrid.
The ideology is explicitly defined in the report as anti-oligarch economic populism.
Right, but it is delivered through a very specific, vehicle-explicit Christian moral language.
Because he is a former public school teacher, but he's also Presbyterian seminarian.
Exactly. The strategy relies on him using that deep theological background specifically to oppose Christian nationalism.
And to aggressively defend the separation of church and state.
It fundamentally flips the script on how religion is typically deployed in modern politics.
The report notes that his primary framing isn't left versus right, it's top versus bottom.
He is trying to rally the working class against concentrated wealth.
And his policy proposals heavily reflect that. For instance, he is pushing to ban Wall Street hedge funds from accumulating single-family housing.
He is also arguing for a federal public health care option.
And his framing on polarizing issues is highly engineered to avoid traditional traps, right? Like, take the border.
Yeah, instead of falling into the open borders versus build the wall binary, his signature phrase is a welcome mat and a lock.
Which means what, practically?
Practically, it means pairing massive funding for asylum courts and processing centers, the welcome mat, with heavy militarization and physical enforcement at ports of entry to crush cartel trafficking.
The lock.
Exactly. And on energy, he is pushing what the report calls an all-of-the-above Texas innovation strategy.
I imagine that's a tough sell to environmental purists, though.
It is, but the mechanics of it make sense for his map. He is arguing for aggressively keeping domestic oil and gas jobs to sustain local tax bases and grid stability.
While simultaneously pouring billions into expanding wind, solar, and battery manufacturing.
Right. It is a bridge policy designed to appeal to a Texas oil rig worker and a climate-conscious young voter simultaneously.
That is a fascinating contrast to recent historical figures. I mean, the report actually points out that his rhetorical style makes him much more explicitly religious than someone like Bernie Sanders ever was.
Yet his policies make him far more anti-corporate and pro-labor than the business-friendly centrism of Bill Clinton in the 1990s.
So he is carving out a lane of faith-rooted, working-class populism that doesn't really have a direct contemporary comparison in the party.
No, it really doesn't.
But wait, this brings us to a massive, glaring contradiction in this strategy.
Let's hear it.
The report insists his signature message is top versus bottom. He is supposed to be out there constantly attacking billionaires, dark money, and corporate greed.
Right.
But we just discussed how he raised $72 million in a matter of months. How on earth do you run a credible anti-oligarch, anti-billionaire campaign on a massive national-scale donor budget?
It's a huge paradox.
Wouldn't he just sound like a massive hypocrite to the voters?
The report dedicates an entire section to this exact problem. They label it the anti-billionaire funding contradiction.
Okay, so what's their solution?
The authors argue there is only one viable mechanism to escape that trap, and it requires absolute ruthless consistency. The campaign has to set incredibly transparent donor rules up front and broadcast them constantly.
Like refusing corporate paid money.
Going much further than that, they have to rely so heavily on the sheer, overwhelming scale of small-dollar donations that they can mathematically prove the big money is being diluted.
Oh.
But the most critical mechanism is access. The strategy dictates that the campaign must publicly and loudly refuse policy access to wealthy donors.
Basically telling donors, we will gladly cash your check, but you are not getting our phone number and you aren't getting a seat at the table.
Exactly. They have to demonstrate instances where they took a maximum contribution from a wealthy executive and then actively pushed legislation that hurt that executive's bottom line.
It is a razor-thin line to walk.
Very thin.
Because if an investigative journalist finds even one instance of a wealthy donor getting special treatment or a private meeting that influenced policy,
the entire top versus bottom brand completely shatters.
So a brand is ultimately just a theory until it actually survives the brutal math of a primary election.
And this strategy report maps out a path to 270 electoral votes that requires navigating a primary calendar that looks utterly exhausting.
The logistical nightmare of this primary cannot be overstated. The Democratic National Committee has implemented a new early window calendar for 2028, and it is a pure sprint.
Yeah, let's look at those dates. South Carolina votes on January 22nd.
Okay.
Then you have Nevada on February 1st, New Hampshire on February 8th, New Mexico on the 15th, Michigan on the 22nd, and Virginia on the 29th.
Wow.
That is six highly diverse states in about 5 weeks.
Why is that compressed timeline such a specific challenge for a candidate like Tallarico?
Because of the mechanics of momentum. In the old days, a candidate could focus all their resources on winning Iowa or New Hampshire, and if they got a surprise victory, they could use the free media coverage over the next month to quickly raise money and build infrastructure in the later states.
Oh, I see. A five-week sprint completely breaks that model.
Exactly. If you win New Hampshire on February 8th, you have exactly 1 week before New Mexico votes. You cannot just fly to Albuquerque and start shooting television ads.
You needed to have field offices, ground teams, and millions of dollars in ad buys locked in 6 months prior.
You have to have a massive national infrastructure already fully funded and humming before a single vote is even cast.
And keep in mind his starting point. The report cites a July 2026 Emerson national ballot test, and Tallarico wasn't even named as an option.
Yeah, heavyweights like Pete Buttigieg and Gavin Newsom were leading that poll.
So he is starting from absolute zero in the national consciousness.
Which is why that very first contest in South Carolina is an existential hurdle. The report states unequivocally that he cannot win the nomination without establishing deep, authentic trust with Black voters and Black church networks early on.
Unlike a candidate from Georgia or North Carolina, he does not have a natural regional home state base to lean on in that early window.
Right. His faith-rooted messaging has to resonate immediately in South Carolina, or the campaign dies in January.
Okay, let's assume he survives that gauntlet and secures the nomination. The report then maps out the math for the general election.
Yeah, they start with a baseline of 226 electoral votes, assuming he holds the states the Democratic ticket won in 2024.
From there, they outline a few mechanical paths to hit the magic number of 270.
They model a blue wall path, which relies on holding Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
They model a Sunbelt path focused on flipping Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada, or a hybrid of the two.
And securing those paths requires an incredibly sophisticated ground game during the primary to test those coalitions. Remember, in the Democratic primary, delegates are awarded proportionally, And there is a strict 15% viability threshold.
Right. Break down how that threshold actually dictates strategy on the ground.
It means you cannot just run generic statewide television ads and hope to come in a respectable second place overall. The delegates are awarded based on congressional districts. If a candidate polls at 14% in a specific district, they get zero delegates from that area.
Zero. Wow.
So a campaign has to deploy highly localized tactical coalitions. They have to know exactly which counties, which suburbs, and which specific neighborhoods they need to target to cross that 15% line.
It forces a campaign to prove they can win over very specific demographics like factory workers in a Michigan district or suburbanites in a Virginia district.
Exactly.
Which brings up a glaring question about his map. His entire mythology is supposed to be the guy who flipped Texas.
Right.
But this strategy report explicitly warns the campaign not to build the 2028 general election map around Texas.
Yeah, they are very clear about that.
It classifies Texas's 40 electoral votes merely as an expansion state. I mean, why build an entire political identity around winning a massive red state if your own internal strategists are telling you that you can't actually rely on it for the math?
That is what the authors refer to as the danger of Texas exceptionalism.
Texas exceptionalism.
Yeah, the electoral math in a presidential year is unforgiving. Donald Trump won Texas by 13.7 points in 2024.
That is a structural massive margin.
The report warns that a midterm Senate win in 2026, especially against a uniquely flawed, scandal-plagued opponent like Ken Paxton, does not mathematically guarantee that a presidential candidate can replicate that flip 2 years later in a higher turnout environment.
Oh, because it's a completely different electorate in a presidential year.
Exactly. The warning is stark. If Tallarico's voter coalition only functions effectively in Texas, then it is a regional phenomenon, not a national coalition.
Texas is an expensive, high-risk bonus prize. It cannot be the foundation of a 270 electoral vote strategy.
He has to prove his message works in Pennsylvania and Nevada, not just in Dallas and Houston.
So we have established that his path to victory requires reaching voters far outside traditional Democratic circles and proving his brand works across vastly different demographics.
Right.
But how does he actually get his message in front of them without being filtered by the traditional news networks? That brings us to his media strategy, which this report details with fascinating precision.
The medium really is the message here.
It is a completely decentralized, modern media apparatus.
The strategy explicitly bypasses traditional cable news town halls in favor of a bifurcated approach.
Yeah, they combine incredibly fast, viral 90-second short-form clips optimized for TikTok, Instagram Reels, and YouTube Shorts.
With multi-hour, unedited, long-form podcast interviews designed to build deep parasocial trust.
And the validator they point to for this strategy is massive. The report highlights that Joe Rogan publicly urged Tallarico to run for president during one of those long-form, multi-hour interviews.
Getting that kind of blessing from Rogan provides him immediate credibility and access to an audience entirely outside the normal, highly curated Democratic media ecosystem.
The report even codifies his specific communication formula for these platforms into a three-step mechanism.
It's very systematic. Step one is a moral story. He always frames an issue around the fundamental question of how we treat our neighbors.
Step two is an economic conflict. He immediately points the finger at concentrated corporate power or corrupt systems that are making life unaffordable for those neighbors.
And step three is practical proof. He backs up the moral outrage with specific, granular legislative mechanics, so he doesn't just sound like a preacher giving a sermon.
But spending hundreds of hours on long-form podcasts comes with a massive, terrifying liability.
Oh, definitely.
The report refers to it as the Culture War Archive. Every hour you spend on a microphone is an hour of searchable, unedited opposition research you are handing directly to your rivals.
And the AP and Reuters are already reporting that Republican operatives are aggressively mining his old social media posts and his old seminary sermons for attacks.
There is a specific, highly publicized clip where he stated, "God is non-binary," that is already being weaponized against him in attack ads.
And that vulnerability is compounded by the fact that his hybrid brand forces him to thread an impossible needle on policy.
Like the Middle East.
Exactly. Take a stance there. He is trying to articulate a position where he supports Israeli security, but staunchly opposes providing offensive weapons to the Netanyahu government.
Well, while simultaneously calling for the complete disarmament of Hamas.
In a hyperpolarized environment, attempting that kind of nuance risks alienating practically every single activist group involved.
So if you are his campaign manager, how do you handle this? Is being a podcast star actually a double-edged sword that will ultimately bleed the campaign dry?
It's a huge risk.
It is phenomenal for reaching young, disillusioned voters. But doesn't the sheer volume of him talking out loud make him a walking opposition research folder? How do you mathematically survive that many controversies?
The authors of the report are brutally honest about this reality. Overexposure is his greatest media threat.
Yeah.
To survive it, the campaign must engineer what they call a rapid clip risk protocol.
A clip risk protocol.
Yeah, it is essentially like trying to navigate a ship while the crew is constantly patching holes below deck. They need an exhaustive internal audit of every single word he has ever said on a microphone.
Oh, wow. That sounds exhausting.
When an old controversial quote surfaces, and it is a mathematical certainty that it will, they have to be able to instantly recontextualize it, plainly acknowledge if the phrasing was intentionally provocative, and then ruthlessly pivot the conversation right back to his core economic message of cost of living and affordability.
Because if they spend all their time playing defense, arguing about theology, or defending old tweets, the ship stops moving forward.
Precisely. If the media cycle becomes about his sermons rather than his housing policy, they lose the economic argument entirely and the coalition fractures.
Which brings us to a perfect summary of this entire deep dive.
When you synthesize all the data, the polling, and the media tactics, the Telerica 2028 concept is ultimately one massive if-then statement.
It is a live-fire experiment testing whether a synthesis of progressive economics, religious pluralism, and cultural non-contempt can actually survive the meat grinder of the American political machine.
But the entire meticulously planned architecture, the electoral map, the podcast strategy, the donor mechanisms, it all dies on the vine if he doesn't figure out how to win that Senate seat in 2026.
And bringing this all back to you, the listener, whether you are a hardcore political junkie mapping out delegates in your free time, or just someone scrolling your phone on the train wondering why your feeds are suddenly flooded with very specific 90-second clips of certain politicians, this blueprint shows you exactly how the sausage is made.
It really pulls back the curtain.
It demonstrates how modern campaigns are engineered behind closed doors, blending the art of digital virality with cold, hard, unforgiving electoral math.
It is a great reminder that it is rarely an accident when a candidate goes viral. That organic-looking moment is often the very top of a highly deliberate, thoroughly tested funnel designed to turn human attention into donations, and donations into delegates.
And I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over as you watch the next few election cycles unfold.
Yep.
This strategy report specifically targets young men through anti-establishment podcasts as a key must-win demographic for Telerico. Now, we know from recent data that this specific demographic has skewed heavily conservative over the last few cycles.
Very heavily.
Could the future viability of the Democratic Party actually lie in reclaiming that podcast bro demographic?
That is the big question.
And if so, how much of their traditional cultural platform will they be forced to sacrifice or, you know, water down to actually win those voters back into the fold?
It is the ultimate trade-off that every political coalition eventually has to face. Growth always demands compromise.
It really does. And it brings us right back to our opening thought experiment. To compress 10 years of political evolution into a 24-month sprint, you have to be willing to break some of the traditional rules. We'll be watching closely to see if the timeline holds.